It's good to be starting this series of meetings as we go throughout the next few days. I think I've got the best job in that mine is first, and I get to sit back and listen to everybody else after this. But what we're doing throughout this meeting is we're doing the subject of fight the good fight. The New Testament describes the work of the Christian in several different ways. We're called saints and sheep and servants, and we're also compared to athletes and farmers and other aspects as well. But as I was noticing the reading this morning, we're also compared to soldiers. Soldiers are enlisted in the army or some other branch of military. We know in the past there's been people that have been forced to join the military, but we're not forced to be Christians. We're not forced to be part of this army. It's not through compulsion. It's because of, you know, what the Lord has done for us, that we want to be part of this army of the living God. And so as we go throughout this series of lessons this week, this morning we'll be talking about joining the army. And tonight, Ethan will be talking about knowing your enemy. Then the other three lessons are putting on your armor, winning the battle, and do not be afraid. So I hope these lessons will be useful to everyone and be an encouragement to us as we worship together. In 1894, there was a proprietor of a small confectionery shop in Vicksburg, Tennessee. And this proprietor was dreaming. It's not the kind of dream that comes in the night with sleep, but he was dreaming of something that would, you know, be typical of a person that has vision. He was thinking about something that he wanted to do. He was thinking about a tasty soft drink that he could share with people that would never come to his soda fountain. 8 years before this idea, there was a man named John Pemberton, some of you may recognize that name, in Atlanta, who had he was the man that invented Coca-Cola, and he served that in his soda shop in Atlanta. And there were lots and lots of people that enjoyed that over the 8 years. In fact, it was available at many soda fountains, but that was the only place that it was available, was at a soda fountain. So this man named Joseph Binderhorn wanted to know why Coca-Cola couldn't be made available to other people, and he's the one that thought of bottling it. So he bottled the first Coke, and it was very crude by the standards that we see today. It was in a bottle that had a rubber seal on it, and it had some wires on it that held the rubber seal in place, and the bottles had to be stored upside down. But he had achieved his dream of sharing the Coca-Cola, and so he's either to blame or he's to be thanked for that. And so, you know, these new requests for this bottled Coca-Cola had multiplied greatly, and so very soon, geographically, it was not only all over the nation, but it was all over the world. And so why am I talking about Coca-Cola? Am I craving one right now? No. Well, the reason I bring that up is because Coca-Cola could not reach the masses until it got out of the soda fountain and got into homes and businesses where people live every day. And brethren, neither can the gospel reach the world until we get it out of buildings, out of the buildings where we assemble. And it needs to be in us. It needs to be in our members in such a way that we take it into the world. We take it to others. We take it to other homes. And so we can't, you know, bottle up the gospel of salvation and ship it in cases across the world. It comes by us doing something, things we must do. And so when we talk about joining the army, you know, that's what we're talking about in this lesson. It's something that we need to be motivated to do. When we look at the book of Judges, one of the key points that we see in the book of Judges is in Judges chapter 6 and Judges chapter 7, where we're going to spend a bulk of our time today. And this is an unusual army here, because this army that Gideon put together was one that was greatly pared down after a while. But the reason that we see this is because, as we saw throughout Israel's history, Israel had turned to serve other gods, and the Lord punished them, and they cried for help, and he sends a deliverer. And so, as we noted in our in our classes months ago, this is the cycle that we see that the Israelites did time and time again. They went through this cycle where they would obey God, they cry for help. Then when they got into sin, they would want to deliver. And then there would come a judge who would rescue them from whatever oppressor was there at the time. And then they would enjoy a period of peace. And then the sins of Israel started happening again, and Israel again did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. So in Judges chapter 6, it's typical of this cycle. Israel had been subdued by the Midianites for 7 years. They had gone into hiding into mountains and caves while the enemy came in and took their crops and took their livestock. And in Judges chapter 6 and verse 6, it says Israel was brought very low because of Midian. And the sons of Israel cried to the Lord. And so the answer comes in the form of Gideon, who's described as a valiant warrior, but he was anything but that at the time. But we look at Judges chapter 7 as a period of great success, or an event that was greatly successful. And why is that? Well, let's look at chapter 7, verses 1 through 6. Then Jerubbaal, that is Gideon, all the people who were with him rose early and encamped beside the spring of Herod. And the camp of Midian was north of them by the hill of Moroch in the valley. The Lord said to Gideon, "The people with you are too many for me to give to the Midianites into their hand. Let Israel boast over me, saying, 'My own hand has saved me.' Now therefore, proclaim in the ears of the people, saying, 'Whoever is fearful and trembling, let him return home and hurry away from Mount Gilead.' Then 22,000 of the people returned, and 10,000 remained. And the Lord said to Gideon, 'The people are still too many. Take them down to the water, and I will test them for you there. And any one of whom I say to you, 'This one shall go with you,' shall go with you. And any one of whom I say to you, 'This one shall not go with you,' shall not go." So he brought the people down to the water, and the Lord said to Gideon, "Everyone who laps the water with his tongue as a dog laps, you shall set by himself. Likewise, everyone who kneels down to drink." And the number of those who lapped, putting their hands to their mouth, was 300 men. And the rest of the people knelt down to drink water. And the Lord said to Gideon, "With the 300 men who lapped, I will save you and give the Midianites into your hand, and let all the others go, every man to his home." So the people took provisions in their hands and their trumpets, and he sent all the rest of Israel, every man to his tent, but retained the 300 men in the camp of Midian was below him in the valley. And so we see here that the Midianites had gathered and they were going to plunder and destroy Israel's crops. But this time Israel is going to put up a fight and stop the Midianites. And Gideon sends this word out. And then God starts trimming down the number of people that is going to do this thing. And you can imagine how this might have seemed to the people, or even to Gideon, because he, first of all, he says, if any of you are afraid of these odds, and what were the odds? Well, there's 135,000 of them, and there's 32,000 of us. So already the odds were in the Midianites' favor. And so we're already outnumbered 4-1. And so if you're afraid of that, go ahead and go home. And so, two-thirds of them ended up going home. 22,000 men are kicking up a cloud of dust as they leave. And so the army is shrunk by two-thirds, from 32 to 10,000. And so now, how are they outnumbered? Not 4-1, but 13-1. And God is not finished leveling, the playing field here. And he has Gideon put the army through the test and takes the troops down to the stream to get a drink of water. And so he tells Gideon to watch how they drink. And of course, he takes the 300 who lap the water like a dog. And so here, the 300 men are chosen. And now what are the odds? I'm not really good at math, but what we see now is it's 450-1. Those are the odds. Of course, God loves those kind of odds. Those are great odds for God. And Gideon is going to march not into battle with the 32,000 men that he started with, but the 300 men you know, that's not the way that we would have chosen to do that. And so what we see here is that God, you know, prepares an army, and the ones that are being used here are certainly needful. And we want to notice some things about the 300 and what it was that Gideon and God had them do. If you think about 300, if this were man-to-man combat, you know, every Israel soldier would have to kill 450 men. Now, if you're an Avenger, you can do that, maybe. But this is not something that they're going to be able to do with their human strength. But what we see as we look through the passage here, that God is going to make use of all of these men, and they're all going to have something to do as they go into battle. So even being outnumbered in this great amount, God is making use of every man. And what we want to see here is that this applies to us too. We want to make an application to ourselves that we are needful in the kingdom of God, that there is an army that we need to join, and that every soldier is essential. And so you consider the number that's encamped against us. And I think we see that a lot in our society today, because I think one of the things is the media. And when I was growing up, just so you kids know how old I am, we had to actually get up out of our seat to go change the channel. And that didn't happen very often, because we only had three, you know, to change it to. And if you wiggled the antenna enough, you might have gotten another channel. So we didn't have the internet. And if you weren't talking to somebody local, you really weren't allowed to use the phone either, because of the long distance charges. So we didn't have the media like we have today. And so we hear a lot of bad news. We hear things that are going on other places. And I think sometimes the wealth of information that we have makes us feel more oppressed than maybe we did in the past. But let's just think about the world in which we live now. We feel like the enemy is on every side of us. There's social and there's moral issues. And it seems like the enemy is everywhere. And students that are in school, you know, they come home and they learn new words, or they hear things that they shouldn't have heard, or they have to grow up really quickly because of the things that they're exposed to. And we're affected that way in our work too. And there's pressure to fit in socially and to do things that are dishonest. And so everywhere that we go, we see that we're in a fight. Or we see a fight around us to remain moral, to remain pure, to remain pleasing to God. And we even see problems in churches. Churches are you know, just today or yesterday, you know, I won't reveal what it was that we were talking about, but Jarell was seeing some church members that she knows in other areas that are involved in some things that are really questionable as far as morality goes. That they're making a decision that's not really good for a Christian to make, yet they are publicizing this decision of their kids. Yay, you know, that they are able to do this thing. And so we even see, you know, that kind of thing, immorality creeping in to the church and conforming with society. So the point is we've got an enemy on every side of us. And so what does that mean? It means that we are needed in the Lord's army. The army of the Lord, you cannot afford to have soldiers, you know, sitting on the sideline in battle. Moses, in Numbers chapter 32, he asked the tribes of Reuben and Gad, "Shall your brothers go to war while yourselves just sit here?" And of course, the obvious answer is no, that's not what was appropriate. They are essential. And we are essential, and we need to fight the battle. When we look at Judges chapter 7, and we see how the Lord trimmed the number, and I believe certainly the 22,000 that were fearful, you know, that was not a great thing on their part, that they were too fearful to fight. You look at the ones that lapped the water, and sometimes we speculate about, well, you know, the ones that that lapped the water, you know, maybe they were in a better position to see their surroundings and things, and we speculate about that. It seems more that this is just a way to trim the number, but you know, whatever, the number is trimmed, and God has done that. What if God decided to trim us, trim our number? He said, okay, you know, I'm going to trim the number here. I'm going to dismiss all those who don't pray. I'm going to dismiss all those who don't study. I'm going to dismiss all those who are not really devoted, those who are weak, those who don't want to be here. And, you know, there are times when, you know, professors in school will tell you that there's going to be a bunch of you in this class that are not going to, you know, pass it. I remember that very well. That was a great way to start the class, to tell us the percentage of the people that aren't going to make it to the end. Let's just go ahead and walk out right now. That's the way I felt. But, you know, we have God trimming the number here. And, of course, He's not telling us, okay, everybody that doesn't pray can walk out and leave. He doesn't say, but what would happen if He did that? Would we make the first cut? Would we make the final cut? Would we be one of the final 300? The army of the Lord requires faith. When you look at the ones that left, they left because they were afraid. They didn't have the faith that they needed. But every soldier that was still there of the 300, they stood in spite of a great mismatch. That was a horrible, horrible mismatch. There's a book called One Crowded Hour, and the author Tim Bowden describes an incident in Borneo in 1964. Nepalese fighters known as Gurkhas, they were asked if they would be willing to jump from airplanes to combat against the Indonesians. The Gurkhas didn't clearly understand what was involved, but they bravely said that they would do that, that they would jump from the airplanes to go into combat. But they asked this, they said, please have the plane fly slowly over a swampy area, no higher than 100 feet. And when they were told there were parachutes that would not have time to open at that height, the Gurkhas replied, well, you didn't tell us there were parachutes. You know, what they were thinking, they had said, yes, we'll do it, but we need the plane to fly really low over a swamp, because they're thinking they're just going to jump out. You know, that's really brave, isn't it? And that's, you know, dedication to that cause. And when I think about, you know, Gideon's 300, they were like these guys. They were brave, and it didn't look like what they were getting into was going to turn out well. Gideon's men were not trained soldiers. In fact, the Lord left some of the nations in Canaan so that the sons of Israel might be taught war. If you look back at Judges chapter 3. Another reason we know they were not trained soldiers is you look at their weapons of warfare. Pitchers, trumpets, a torch. This is not something that you'd find in the military catalog. But, of course, Israel had God on their side. This was something that was more powerful than any enemy could have. They needed to have faith. They needed to believe that they were fighting a battle that God was going to win for them. And so these are not insurmountable odds when you look at what God can do. If you look in verse 15 says, as soon as Gideon heard the telling of the dream and interpreted it, he worshipped. And this is back up just a little bit so we can see this dream. In verse 12, and the Midianites and Amalekites and all the people of the east lay along the valley like locusts in abundance, and their camels without number, and the sand that is on the seashore in abundance. When Gideon came, behold, a man who was telling a dream to his comrade, and he said, behold, I dreamed a dream, and behold, a cake of barley bread tumbled into the camp of Midian. and struck the tent so that it fell and turned it upside down so that the tent lay flat. And the comrade answered, "This is no other than the sword of Gideon, the son of Joash, the man of Israel. God has given into his hand Midian and all the camp." So this dream, this loaf of bread that falls into the camp and it smashes the tent flat. Now, this was a vision that this is all going to turn out okay. This is a vision that Midian is not going to survive this. Even though they are numbered like the locusts, they are numbered like the sands of the sea, they are going to be led into victory despite these apparent insurmountable odds. One of the most interesting verses that we can see here is where it says that every soldier stood in his place. Every soldier stood in his place. So Gideon stations 300 men in a circle around the camp. And then there's the signal. And what happens? They break the pitchers. They make noise. They blow the trumpets. They shouted. Chapter 7, verse 20 says, a sword for the Lord and for Gideon. And what happens here is that the enemy is sent into confusion. Let's look at verse 15. As soon as Gideon heard the telling of the dream and its interpretation, he worshipped and he returned to the camp of Israel and said, "Arise, for the Lord has given the host of Midian into your hand." And he divided the 300 men into three companies and put trumpets in the hands of all of them and empty jars and torches inside the jars. And he said to them, "Look at me and do likewise. When I come to the outskirts of the camp, do as I do. When I blow the trumpet, I and all those who are with me, then blow the trumpets on every side, and all the camp shout for the Lord and for Gideon." So Gideon, the 100 men who were with him, came to the outskirts of the camp at the beginning of the middle watch when they had just set the watch. And they blew the trumpets and smashed the jars that were in their hands. Then three companies blew the trumpets and broke the jars. They held in their left hands the torches and in their right hand the trumpets to blow. They cried out, "A sword for the Lord and for Gideon." Every man stood in his place around the camp. And all the army ran. They cried out and fled. And when they blew the 300 trumpets, the Lord set every man's sword against his comrade and against all the city, or against all the army. And the army fled as far as Bethshitta toward Zerah, and as far as the border of Abel-Meholah by Tabith. And the men of Israel were called out from Naphtali and from Asher and from all Manasseh, and they pursued after Midian. So, really, Midian turned on themselves in all this confusion, started killing each other. But it says here that every soldier stood in his place. If you were one of those 300 men that were left here, and this is what you've been asked to do, you had to have a lot of faith to do this in the midst of the sands of the seashore and all the locusts here of the Midianites. But at the signal, they did what they were supposed to do. They broke the pitchers, they held up the torches, they blew the trumpets, and did exactly what they were supposed to do. So everybody was where they were supposed to be, but what if they weren't? What might have happened if just a few said, "This doesn't make any sense. This is crazy. I'm leaving. This will never work." Or, "I'm not that important. You know, there's still enough. There's 299 others. I'm not that important." One commentary I was looking at said that they will get an A or they'll get an F. But A, in this case, was bad because A is afraid and F is fearless. So you need to, in this case, you need to get an F. You need to be fearless in the sight of insurmountable odds. And also, remember, every person here was a volunteer because they all had the chance to leave. They were of the number that chose not to leave. And so, you know, Gideon's army was vastly dwindled from what it was. So the ones that remained were true volunteers. They were not somebody that had to be coerced. I know in our nation's history, we have different times in our history where people are coerced or they are drafted to be part of something they didn't want to be a part of. That's not what this is. This is a commitment. And sometimes you may even hear Christians give an account of how they became a Christian and how somebody had to coerce them or they had to be drugged in it by their family. And hopefully at some point in their life, they were truly dedicated to God instead of being pushed, pulled, and drugged into it by somebody else. That they're here voluntarily. They're doing it because they want to, not because of a sense of compulsion or being forced into it. And God needs that. He needs people that are volunteers. He needs people that want to be here. And in Gideon's army, everybody was a volunteer. And they were all equipped. And they were all alert. And they were all obedient to what seemed like a crazy mission. So they needed to be in their place. One of my teachers at Florida College was Brent Hunter. And some of you may know Brent Hunter, and I think he was the only teacher that could have kept me awake for a 7 o'clock Bible class. And I won't say that he was always successful, but I have a book that he wrote years and years ago called Evangelism, Personal Evangelism 101. And it has a lot of good information, and I want to share something with you. And it's a little bit of a lengthy reading, but I think it will be beneficial to you for us to read this. And if you ever get a chance to look, just do a Google search for Personal Evangelism 101. You can find the whole book that he wrote. Lots of good information. But this is called Foot Soldiers. An army general making a speech recently to an assembled group of military leaders said, "All the technology in the world will never eliminate the need for the foot soldier." He was right. Satellites and guided missiles and poison gas and battleships and automatic weapons and computers and high explosives and all the rest will never eliminate the need for intelligent human beings and to really go into possess the land. Soon after reading the above quotation, we attended a number of meetings where church leaders gather, planning sessions, leadership seminars, elders meetings, workshops, and the rest. And by the way, Brent Hunter didn't write this. It was written by somebody else back in the 60s. But it says that we gathered planning sessions, leadership seminars, elders meetings, workshops, and the rest. We heard practically every plan imaginable proposed that would convert the world without having to get out and do it personally. It is amazing what the human brain can come up with if it will eliminate personal involvement. We want our programs to convert the world. We buy buses, we advertise, we bring in experts to enthuse us, we appoint committees, we delegate authority, anything to keep from having to get out and eyeball a sinner and tell him that he is a sinner and that only Jesus can save him. We develop our mission strategy. We school our teams for years in the mechanics of teamwork and evangelism. Then we raise vast sums to send them and to support them, anything to keep from having to go ourselves. We have read with interest the recent reports of how much the church has shriveled in the past 10 years. Although we do not agree with the implication of those findings, we cannot doubt that in many areas of the nation, the church is much less and congregations have much fewer than 10 years ago. Why? We believe it is because the church has depend on the contribution plate and gadgets and programs and that foot soldiers are disappearing. We want to pay our way rather than put in the work that it takes. We want to import an enthusiastic merchant to temporarily arouse our spiritual adrenaline periodically while we frown on total commitment. There is a lot of difference in enthusiasm and commitment. It pleased God by the foolishness of preaching to save them that believe. We are all men and women alike under the greatest of all commissions. This was the choice of God, which demonstrates the wisdom of God, that they can't believe in whom they have not heard and they cannot hear without a preacher. The power is still in foot soldiers. The Lord's army is not a machine directed by armchair generals from an elder's room. It is a world-covering horde of saved by grace people who appreciate it. Even buying Bibles to send to the far reaches of the earth will not substitute for Christian soldiers going there. Hearts may be softened and the ground prepared by mass media, but 99% of all conversions come from somebody being there, some Aquila or Priscilla who guide the struggling pilgrim to the cross. We are personally glad that the eunuch, when he started home from Jerusalem, did not have to wait for Philip to get his degree in missionology, nor for the church somewhere to put him in their budget. Maybe this is some of the New Testament pattern that needs restoring. It was foot soldiers that went everywhere preaching the gospel. The kingdom has never in any age improved upon this method of evangelism. We still need foot soldiers. It is strange but true, but that the world today is perhaps more ready to listen than we are to preach. Those who are saved are loath to go, while though they that are lost are anxious for us to come. What a paradox. Where are the lips that have been touched with a live coal from the altar? The Lord did not lay the task of evangelism upon machinery. He laid it upon men. All the mass media, however helpful, cannot substitute for one saint communicating the gospel to one sinner. That's the way the world will be saved if it is ever to be saved. God did not give His commission to angels or to a committee, but to men. The church is shrinking because members of the church are shirking, and heaven isn't prepared for shirkers. We do not need enthusiasm in the pulpit like we need commitment in the pew. The Lord needs a commitment from every one of us that He will replace Himself in the remainder of the year, not in 300 years. We could double the size of the church between now and next year if we would. We are part of our own problem when we could provide the solution. That's foot soldiers. I don't know what the situation was when this was written, but it sounds like it could have been written today, doesn't it? There's a lot that's said there, and certainly I believe at the time that was written that the mass media was not what it is today. And there's a lot of dependence on that. But the bottom line is you hear that. I know there's some things in there that we probably might disagree with. But the one thing that is certainly applicable is that we don't need to be the kind of soldier that doesn't want to go into battle. We don't need to be the kind of soldier that's afraid to talk to somebody, or that we want to pay somebody else to do it for us. We need foot soldiers. And so Gideon got these 300 men, and it says they were all in their place. So the question is, are we in our place? Are we where we can be part of the battle plan? Edward Hale said, "I am only one, but I'm still one. I cannot do everything, but I can still do something, and I will not let what I cannot do interfere with what I can do." Sometimes we concentrate a lot on what it is we can't do instead of what it is that we can. God chose soldiers who were unafraid. God chose soldiers who were selfless. And He chose those who were alert. The first men that were set aside were useless because they were afraid. And really, that's one of the biggest lessons that you can get from Gideon is that 22,000 that just walked away. But the ones that remained, they were alert, they were on the job, they were obedient to what it was that they were supposed to do, even though if any of them had any inkling of what would be a normal military campaign, it didn't line up at all. 300 people were selected for a surprise night attack at the enemy's camp. And it was very, very successful. One other thing that they did is they were keeping a watchful eye for the enemy. Ethan's going to be talking more about that this evening. New Testament Christians are warned to be on guard. There is an enemy. There is a fight. There is a battle. And we need to be good foot soldiers. So the burden of this lesson today is that there is an army. And we need to be part of it. We don't want to be part that would be disqualified because we're fearful. We want to be the ones that are there fighting because we're obedient and because we believe in the one who is leading the mission. And that's Jesus Christ. He hasn't given us something that we can't do. We need to be as these 300 men were, each one in his place, and a great victory can be won. Looking forward to the rest of the lessons in the series and how it can encourage us to fight the good fight of faith. And hopefully we can all be encouraged and motivated by that. And if you have not began that battle, it's a battle that needs to be started. As David was reading this morning, Acts chapter 2. The people that believed the gospel on that day, they started a battle. They started a fight. And it's a fight that can be won and has its ultimate victory in heaven. If we can help in any way to do that, we invite you to come while we stand and sing.